I've always struggled with finding time to manage my finances. At the end of a busy week, the last thing I want to do is spend time budgeting all of my expenses or tracking down customer service teams to cancel old subscriptions I no longer use. But now I use Rocket Money, and it does all that for me. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so you can grow your savings. Stop wasting money on the things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Washington Post. That's rocketmoney.com/Washington Post.
Next week is the start of the most lucrative and highly televised event in college sports, March Madness.
3 seconds to go. Takes it all the way. Oh!
That's going to count.
Yes, it will.
Clock goes to two. Anya, a little turnaround, and it goes!
B.J. Anya!
Shock and awe in college basketball.
It's massive business. It's big business, underline. You probably cannot overstate how big business, really, this tournament is.
Jesse Dougherty covers the business of college sports for The Post. He says that the National Collegiate Athletics Association makes over $1 billion a year, and March Madness, the National College Basketball Tournament, accounts for a huge chunk of those profits.
All the money that trickles down to schools and to businesses from the NCAA tournament really is generated by the athletes. You know, it's the product. It is the reason why people tune in. It's the reason why we get so excited every year for all the buzzer beaters and the upsets in your bracket. So the athletes are where this stems from, for sure. But they are not professional athletes, at least by the letter of the law and the NCAA's rules.
The NCAA, or NCAA, argues that there is a distinction between student and professional athletes. Students are amateurs, not paid professionals, and that distinction is core to what makes college sports special, the NCAA argues. But in the last few years, more student athletes have been pushing back against that idea. Just last week,
the Dartmouth men's basketball team officially voted to unionize. And they are the first team in college sports history to do so.
Two players for the team, Cade Haskins and Romeo Myrtle, explained their reasons in the Dartmouth student newspaper. They wrote they were unionizing, quote, not only in a desire to improve our own working conditions, but also in a hope of catalyzing the transformation of college sports into a less exploitative business.
This Dartmouth case is really monumental in that it could potentially establish a precedent for athletes at private schools and then potentially public schools to become employees. And that could really, you know, shake the earth that the NCAA stands on. It could really change everything.
From the newsroom of The Washington Post, this is Post Reports. I'm Elahe Izadi. It's Tuesday, March 12th. Today, why the moment was ripe for the Dartmouth men's basketball team to unionize, and what their efforts tell us about the future of college sports. Jesse, before we get more into what's happening at Dartmouth right now, I want to understand how we even got here, because this is a significant change over the last decade that we've seen in how student athletes have been thought of, how they've approached their roles and their sort of place within the sports ecosystem. So I do want to learn more about how college athletics have historically functioned for the players. I mean, I've been watching college sports for a long time before I went to college. I mean, it's kind of like one of the reasons I picked the college I went to is because they won the NCAA National Basketball Championship. Go Terps. But I don't really know exactly historically how has that relationship been. How have students been treated, and what privileges and rights did they have, these student athletes?
Yeah, so the traditional model is that the schools, especially the bigger major conference schools, like you mentioned, your school, Maryland, make a lot of money on their television deals, at least in the age of television, and they make a lot of money on apparel, and they make a lot of money on ticket sales, and they even make money on student fees that you pay while you're on campus to actually prop up the athletic department, which you maybe didn't even know.
I think I barely knew that.
Yeah, so your tuition was helping the men's basketball and football teams and all the other non-revenue sports. And all that money is used to fund the programs, to build new stadiums, to pay coaches exorbitant and climbing salaries. None of it is actually used to pay players. And the justification over time that the NCAA has used time and time again, both in court, in public, in the court of public opinion, is that a lot of these athletes in football and basketball especially get full scholarships, and that that is their compensation. And the fact that they don't have to pay for college is what they're making. That's the money. And what labor advocates over the years have pushed back on is that doesn't line up with the money they're generating. Even if you priced out a scholarship for a men's basketball player or a football player, and you put it against the March Madness money that the school received from Maryland's run to the Final Four, or you put it against what they receive in television money for football, it was not even close to adding up. And these players were not being sort of, they did not have access to the money they were helping to generate because they are amateurs, because they are students. Now, you also can look at sort of compensation and also revenue generation as a bit more philosophically. Like, not only do schools make money on television deals, they also make money because students like you, Elahe, pick your college because of the men's basketball team.
They got
There's sort of, they got you. So there's sort of an unknown, an unquantifiable way in which culturally, which attracting students, upping enrollment. I mean, we've seen over the years at major schools in the South, like these, as they've sort of had bigger TV contracts in football or have winning seasons, we've seen their enrollment skyrocket.
So for a long time, these student athletes, they weren't being compensated. It didn't sound like they had very much say in the money being made for, you know, in their view, in their labor, at least if we're taking it from this perspective of the student athletes who are organizing and unionizing. But just stepping back, when did things start to change around the country in the relationship that student athletes had with their institutions?
Yeah, there are two instances in the last 10 years that have really changed the relationship. And the first was Ed O'Bannon versus the NCAA. Ed O'Bannon was a UCLA basketball player who filed a lawsuit against the NCAA. He saw himself in a video game and saw the use of a character that didn't have his name but looked just like him, had his number, was playing on UCLA, and he was not getting compensated for that game. So people were. Someone was making money, but it wasn't actually the athletes who were being depicted in the video game. And so he put his name on a case against the NCAA that basically asked for back pay for name, image, and likeness money to athletes who have been used in these ways. And that was a major step toward getting athletes compensation, toward recognizing that the NCAA cannot restrict their earning power on their name, image, and likeness, whether it be on a video game, whether it be in a brand deal or to advertise a shop on campus.
And what was the second instance that changed things?
On the heels of that was this case where Sean Austin, a West Virginia football player, challenged the NCAA's restrictions on education-related money they could pay to athletes. So whether that would be for new laptops or stipends for internships or travel to an academic conference. And that case went to the Supreme Court, and in a 9-0 decision, and as we know in our current Supreme Court, there's not a lot of things that they can agree on, 9-0.
Right.
A 9-0 decision against the NCAA where they basically... They basically said that your whole model is against antitrust law.
I start from the idea that the antitrust laws should not be a cover for exploitation of the student athletes. So,
and Brett Kavanaugh, in his concurring opinion, basically laid out this very long answer that said the NCAA is running afoul to antitrust law in this country, and the whole business model and the whole way they're operating and treating athletes is in violation of antitrust law.
It does seem, as Justice Kagan and Justice Gorsuch suggested, Justice Alito, the schools are conspiring with competitors, agreeing with competitors, I'll say that, to pay no salaries to the workers who are making the schools billions of dollars on the theory that consumers want the schools to pay their workers nothing.
And that Austin case in 2021 led directly to athletes being able to receive money based on their name, image, and likeness, and what we know as NIL.
Jesse, when you say NIL, name, image, and likeness, as sort of shorthand for athletes making money, like what exactly does that mean?
What it means at the moment is that athletes can make money in various ways. They can make money off brand deals, like if they sign with Nike, if you're Caitlin Clark, or something smaller. They can make money by posting for a small product on Instagram and either receiving monetary compensation or that product for free. Or they can make money doing charity work, where there are these booster groups on campus that basically raise money, partner with charities, and then pay athletes sort of de facto salaries for maybe making an appearance at a hospital or posting on Instagram about a various charity in their city. What NIL does not mean is that students are making money from, athletes are making money from their schools or conferences or the NCAA directly.
Like not getting a paycheck or something.
Right. They're not getting a paycheck. They're not employees. They're not getting a cut of television revenue or what their schools make on tickets or merchandise sales. All of it's sort of outsourced to outside brands and sort of fans who maybe give money to these booster collectives and pay athletes.
So that brings us to today and the climate that this unionization effort at Dartmouth is entering in. So before this union vote at Dartmouth, had any other college team tried to unionize?
Yeah, a decade ago at Northwestern, the football team attempted to unionize and got pretty far. In their case, the ballots were impounded, which meant they weren't public, so we don't actually know how they voted. And then before we could see those results, the NLRB ruled against their petition and decided they were not employees.
Yeah. And this is the National Labor Relations Board that's appointed by the president, right?
Yes. And there's some nuances with the Dartmouth situation compared to the Northwestern situation that are really important. The main one is that in Northwestern's case, the NLRB decided that because it can only affect rules at private institutions, the Northwestern's in a conference that has both public and private schools. And they thought that if they made it so the private school in the conference could unionize, that would create an uneven labor environment between those schools. Whereas in the Ivy League, all eight schools are private. This was attempted 10 years ago, but the climate for college sports is far different than it was then.
So why was this vote at Dartmouth different? And why do you think this succeeded when similar efforts failed elsewhere around the country? And does any of it have to do with the fact that tide is sort of, feels like it's sort of turning in a different direction?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's directly related. And the most important answer here is kind of a wonky political sort of rabbit hole, but the NLRB has changed a lot. And they're the ones who are making the initial decisions here on whether these athletes are employees, whether they can make money, whether they can collectively bargain over their working conditions. And when Joe Biden was elected, the first thing he basically did was have a very pro-labor, very athlete-friendly NLRB inserted. There's appointed judges on the panel. There is his appointed general counsel. And she issued a memo in 2021 basically saying athletes are employees, which kind of was like hanging an open sign for these unionization efforts. It was like, you know, if you want to sort of challenge your school or challenge your conference, like, here we are, and this is what we think. And the national board now is ruling on an appeal of Dartmouth's unionization, and they're going to decide whether they are going to let it go forward or stop it in its tracks. But we know that so much has changed. So not only has the climate around college athletics changed, but the labor environment in the country too right now, at least at the national level. So all those factors are combining right now to make this kind of a far different situation than the Northwestern case in a lot of ways. And we've seen that they've advanced farther than Northwestern ever had. And now we're going to see if they can keep pushing that forward.
Jesse, do we know why these players at Dartmouth decided to unionize? Do they speak to their motivations and their reasonings?
So the players have not done a ton of public interviews. And I imagine that's because the process is still ongoing and they don't want to necessarily say things that could be used against them in these appeals process by their school, by the NCAA. That said, the one thing I do know is that they saw other student workers on campus were part of unions. They saw the dining hall workers. They saw people sort of doing similar things that they were. And they said, well, if they can collectively bargain for pay, if they can collectively bargain for their working conditions, for their hours, why can't we? You know, we work a ton. We have a handbook given to us by the program that stipulates what we can and can't do when it comes to things like NIL payments, when it comes to practice time, when it comes to road trips. There are a lot of ways in which we feel like we're treated as employees, but we don't reap the benefits of collectively bargaining because we're not represented right now by a union and we haven't organized. So I think more than anything, like, we haven't seen a list of demands they're going to bring to collective bargaining whenever that may happen. But overall, I think they just wanted a seat at the table. They saw other workers on campus that had that seat and could sort of dictate their working conditions. And they felt like they weren't able to do that and what they provide to the university and also the ways in which university controls their labor and their time. They felt like they were entitled to that.
Jesse, it also strikes me that these student athletes, in some ways, like, if we were to think of them as employees on campus, the labor that they're performing, it's also kind of dangerous. I mean, how many times have we heard about a student athlete having a career-ending injury or, like, the calculus between for, like, a basketball player, a football player, like, oh, should I turn pro before I get injured while I'm still in college and that could end my career? And I'm wondering if any of that is coming into play in these union talks.
It's a great question. And I think when we when we discuss whether athletes on in college campuses are employees or not, and the distinction between whether they're professionals or amateurs, head injuries or concussions or ACL injuries don't make that distinction. They don't really care if you're in the NFL or if you're in college football. They're going to potentially affect you, not just for years, but sometimes for decades all the same. So I'd certainly think that as collective bargaining begins, or if it does begin in Dartmouth's case or with other schools, that sort of health benefits, that sort of long-term health benefits would be certainly part of that conversation. And you're putting your body on the line, and when you're not necessarily being compensated in a standardized way, when you're not sort of getting a cut of all this money that's being made, that makes the situation even more precarious because of the way it could affect your life and your career beyond sports, you know, for years to come.
I can only imagine that other student athletes around the country who feel, the ones who feel similarly to the Dartmouth players are just watching this and thinking, well, yeah, I mean, I don't know. Is this just one school or we could be next? Is that a real thing that could happen?
Totally. I think it's extremely real. And the players at Dartmouth have said their first step is going to be to potentially organize across sports and across schools in the Ivy League. And again, that's something that they can maybe do a bit more easily than trying to reach out across the country because of the mix of private and public schools and the rules that go along with that in terms of unions. But at the Ivy League, with 8 private institutions, they could try to scale this and they could try to organize. And as long as the NLRB is tilted in their favor and is pro-union and is pro-athlete unionization, that's something that that you could see happen. I think it starts small, but if it picks up in enough places, it starts to spread like wildfire.
After the break, how Dartmouth and the NCAA are pushing back against these efforts. We'll be right back.
The best conversations I have with my colleagues are the ones that happen when no one is looking, when we're not 100% sure yet what to write.
Hopefully, having conversations like this can help you figure out your own point of view. That's kind of our job as Washington Post opinions columnists. I'm Charles Lane, Deputy Opinion Editor.
And I'm Amanda Ripley, a contributing columnist. We're going to bring you into these conversations on a new podcast called Impromptu.
Follow Impromptu now, wherever you listen.
Hey, this is Christina Quinn. I'm the host of Try This, the Washington Post's new series of audio courses. The idea behind Try This is to become better functioning humans without having to comb the internet for countless hours. In our first course, we learned how to sleep better. Now, we're going to learn how to make our friendships stronger. I'll offer expert tips that are doable, and I'll keep it short. So let's do this. Class is in session. Find Try This from the Washington Post wherever you listen.
Jesse, do we know how Dartmouth and other academic institutions are responding to this moment?
We do. They are not happy. They overtly not happy. Yeah. Dartmouth called this inappropriate, both this ruling on athletes being employees and the athletes organizing. So they're definitely seem like they're steeling for a long fight, and they're going to fight this effort, and they're going to appeal as much as possible. Talking to Charlie Baker, the NCAA president recently, he was asked about the plan of action should Dartmouth's vote go through. This was before they actually voted to unionize. And he basically said, remember how long NLRB processes can take. And to me, that was a sign that we're going to fight this thing as long as we have to. And it's not going to stop at this first appeal if it doesn't go in Dartmouth's favor. It's going to go to the next appellate court and then potentially to the Supreme Court if that's what it takes. So it'd be interesting to see what lawsuits and what sort of things happen in the environment in that time, because that's not like it's going to happen tomorrow. That could take months and years, and a lot could change. But for this specific case, the school and the NCAA has already pretty publicly made it known that they're going to fight as much as possible.
Well, I guess the question is, how does the NCAA see this? Why is it important to them, beyond if we were just to look at the money of it? What is their argument for why it's important to almost preserve this arena of sports from being totally professionalized and all of the money that flows into it and what that means for the individual players? Like, does that impact the sport?
Yeah, I mean, I think, one, you're totally right and fair to ask beyond the money question, but it's also probably fair to point out that there really is not many other equations at the end of the day when it comes to all this. I mean, that's generally where these arguments, why they happen and what they hinge on. So on the financial aspect, like the NCAA would say, if every school in the country had to start paying every athlete minimum wage, let's say, or something around it, then schools are going to lose programs. Schools are going to lose non-revenue sports. Football and basketball will survive because they're schools that make a lot of money for their programs and for their campuses. But maybe the men's wrestling team, the men's soccer team, the women's volleyball team, like those programs are at risk because a lot of schools can't afford that. That would be sort of the case against unionization nationwide. So maintaining amateurism is sort of financially prudent for their schools and their members and for them. And then also they think it sort of allows them to keep offering the same number of opportunities for all those other athletes. Now, the counter would say, what if we cut coaching salaries? So for a lot of these schools, the public schools, the football coach is the highest paid employee in the state, not just on campus, in the whole state, more than governors, you know, more than all these people. So when schools sort of cry that they can't afford their softball program because they have to potentially pay students minimum wage, something you could say is, well, what are your other expenses? Like, what are you spending on facilities? How many buildings have you built in the last 5 years? What do your coaches make? So I think there are valid arguments on both sides.
Yeah. So the NCAA fought against these efforts for students to be able to, student athletes to make money off their names, images, and likenesses, and these other efforts. They had these fears that they expressed. Have their fears come to pass since these changes have happened?
That's a great question, because what the NCAA's defense is, and without getting into the legal minutiae, their defense has basically been that if you let athletes make money, if we open up this Pandora's box, then NCAA sports are going to cease to exist, or they're never going to be the same, or people will not tune in, and people will not, you know, be excited anymore about their school because they're going to be so turned off by the fact that these athletes are making money. We've actually seen the opposite happen. So the main defense for the NCAA has sort of been cracked by what's happened since athletes were able to monetize off their NIL. Think about Caitlin Clark right now in Iowa basketball. She's selling out arenas the first time ever that the entire Big Ten women's basketball tournament was sold out. And she's making money from State Farm and from Nike and Gatorade, but no one's sitting in the stands seemingly and saying, man, I'm really mad that Caitlin Clark has that Nike money. They're really excited to see her play basketball.
And they're also paying like hundreds of dollars to see her play basketball, right?
Also that. And TV ratings are higher than ever, and the TV money keeps climbing. And I actually think that the biggest thing working against the NCAA in court is that if your argument over and over and over is that this will ruin college sports as we know them, but every time there's a development, college sports gets more popular, you either need to think of a new argument or accept that things have changed. So that's sort of been the sort of result of all this, is that it seems like interest has only picked up. And now, are there issues in the system? Sure. But the overall sort of health of the idea of college sports, of the business of college sports, has probably never been better in a lot of ways.
So, Jesse, what comes next when it comes to the Dartmouth team and their unionization efforts? And also, what is a big unanswered question you have right now that you're going to be interested in following in the days and months and years to come?
So what comes next with Dartmouth is this appeal. Dartmouth has appealed to the national board, the NLRB's four-person national board, and they're going to decide whether or not the students are employees, and they're going to decide whether the initial ruling by the regional director was in line with employment law. And then we're going to go from there and see if this keeps getting challenged to higher courts. So that's sort of the major thing with Dartmouth. It's just seeing how this appeal plays out and seeing sort of what the future will hold based on that decision. If the NLRB rules against Dartmouth, that's over for now. If they rule with the school, then it's going to take another team on another campus to make a similar effort, similarly to Dartmouth picking up where Northwestern left off. I don't think there will be a 10-year gap again. I think it will probably happen sooner rather than later, but it would sort of stop Dartmouth in its tracks of trying to unionize and dial back sort of the effort a bit. And then in terms of what I'm looking for is, I think with this unionization question, It's going to be fascinating how this scales across not just teams, but sports, conferences, Division I, Division II, Division III. So I'm really fascinated, and I'm going to be asking around and trying to figure out how this thing looks when it spreads. It's maybe easy to sort of think on one campus how this looks, because for Dartmouth's case, you could use the same model as the dining workers and the student workers on campus who are already unionized. But Dartmouth, you don't exist in a vacuum. you know, you're part of this sort of bigger ecosystem, this living, breathing college sports ecosystem that a lot, you know, what happens at one school can sort of set precedent for what happens at hundreds of schools and could change a lot and affect things both positively and negatively. So I think it's a really fascinating story in that way. And I don't have the answers to it. I don't know if anyone does, but I think seeing how it will play out will be critical for college sports as we know them.
Well, Jesse, thank you so much for joining me and explaining all of this.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Jesse Dougherty covers the business of college sports for The Post. Before we go, here's another story we're keeping an eye on. There was a big hearing on Capitol Hill today with Robert Herr, the former special counsel who investigated President Biden's handling of classified documents. If you remember, Herr released a report last month concluding he would not prosecute Biden, in part because Biden had returned the classified documents that he had kept. But he wrote that a jury would see the president sympathetically as, quote, an elderly man with poor memory. House Republicans grilled Herr on his decision to not prosecute Biden, while former President Trump had been charged with keeping classified documents. Democrats emphasized the difference between the two cases. But Herr also addressed the other big elephant in the room.
The evidence and the president himself put his memory squarely at issue.
Herr defended including his assessment of Biden's memory in his report.
My assessment in the report about the relevance of the president's memory was necessary and accurate and fair. Most importantly, what I wrote is what I believe the evidence shows and what I expect jurors would perceive and believe. I did not sanitize my explanation, nor did I disparage the president unfairly.
That's it for Post Reports. Thanks for listening. Today's show was produced by Peter Bresnan. It was mixed by Sean Carter and edited by Monica Campbell. If you love Post Reports, there is an easy way to spread the word about it by leaving a rating on Spotify or a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. It's a simple way to help other people discover the show, and we also love hearing what you think about what we do. I'm Elahe Izadi. We'll be back tomorrow with more stories from The Washington Post.
Hey, this is Christina Quinn. I'm the host of Try This, The Washington Post's new series of audio courses. The idea behind Try This is to become better functioning humans without having to comb the internet for countless hours. In our first course, we learned how to sleep better. Now, we're going to learn how to make our friendships stronger. I'll offer expert tips that are doable, and I'll keep it short. So let's do this. Class is in session. Find Try This from the Washington Post wherever you listen.